Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Happy Monday and welcome to another episode of the Compliance Guy Monday Auditing Coding Compliance Roundtable. As always, I want to begin by saying thank you all so much for tuning in, logging on, and just hanging out with us for a little while. We are live right now. This is not pre-recorded. We are looking forward to a really great discussion today. We've got three excellent topics that we're going to address. And then as always, we look forward to your comments, your questions, and areas of concern that you want us to take a look at and maybe opine on as time permits. So I am joined by Paul Spencer, Stephanie Auer, Christine Hall, and Terry Fletcher. Welcome to the program. And real quick, I just want to give a plug to AMBA, the American Medical Billing Association. Christine Hall, myself, Ron Chapman, and a whole host of excellent industry experts are going to be in Hawaii next week for their conference. Very much looking forward to that. Some loco moco, some garlic shrimp, some poke bowls.
Wait, teriyaki? The teriyaki pineapple burger.
Oh, yeah.
That I got to have.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yes, incredible. Yes. All right. So before we get too far down the rabbit hole of talking about food, let's go ahead and jump straight into our first topic today, which is the Medicare physician fee schedule and what that actually means to providers. It was a mind-blowing, incredible increase that providers got. I can't believe how generous Congress was with this. So Terry, let me kick it over to you first, and we'll start talking about this. What does it mean to providers and to everybody out there?
Well, first of all, when anything happens that the Congress, you know, finally gets off their butt and does something on this side of the world when it comes to Medicare or anything like that, do you notice how they congratulate themselves? They're always like, guess what we did? And we gave you this and we did that. Like, we're supposed to thank them. And then you look at the realities of what it is and you're like, I'm not saying thank you. I'm saying, is that it? So here's what actually happened. So just a little preface. MGMA has actually been a big voice for this. They've been fighting, you know, for physicians for a very long time, but they, you know, we got a 3.4% reduction or cut in our Medicare Part B physician fee schedule for 2024. And it was brutal. I mean, let's face it, we go back to 2020, where it was 36.09, and that's the conversion factor. And then 2021, where it was 34.89, and then 34.60, and then 33.88. And then in 2024, it was all the way down to 32.74.744, which was, if you count for inflation, it was similar to what we were getting paid in 1972. So, which is just, you know, I wouldn't even tell you how old Paul and I were then. So here's the problem, is that doctors are also dealing with the 2% sequestration, which was from the 2013 Obama days with the debt ceiling. And again, they attack the Medicare fee schedule. So anytime you get a check, they immediately take out that 2% on top of what you're already getting the reduction. And so there are a lot of complaints. I mean, to the point where doctors are like, I'm opting out. I'm tired of this. Well, they got back to Congress. Congress said, okay, in the last relief package, they call it, but it's taxpayer money. They basically said, we're going to go ahead and just give you a raise and we're going to give it back in 1.4%. I'm like, wait a minute. If we were cut 3.4%, giving us back 1.4, it still means we were cut 2%. So our fee schedule now for the rest of the year, and let's be clear, it's not for services billed after March 1st. It's for services performed after March 1st. So it's not retro. So for the first couple of months of the year, we're still at the same fee schedule of conversion factor of 32.744, but they gave us back 57 cents. And so now it's 33.314 from March 1st of 2024 services through December 2024. But I'm going to say, but because this is ridiculous, we're still getting the 2%. Remember the PAYGO, which was the pay as you go, attacking again the Medicare fee schedule from the $1.9 trillion relief package of 2021. That's been pushed 2 years, and it's already set to, again, attack the fee schedule in 2025. That's considered 4%. And then they just passed another ridiculous amount that actually doesn't help us at all. And so now it's going to be another 2% that's going to be attacked in 2025. So at some point, it reminds me of backing through town. You know, it's like at some point we're going to be paying them to see Medicare patients. But it's hard to sustain this. And this is a Band-Aid. This is not a fix. This is a Band-Aid. And it's just ridiculous. So be aware that that was the breaking news last week. And it just saddens me that physicians are, their fee schedule is last. You know, I just don't understand that mentality when they keep adding services to the Medicare pie, but they keep lowering what we're getting paid for it.
Well, here's the thing that bothers me on top of all of that, right? So you have the sequestration, you have the PAYGO, you have all these other things going on. But what people aren't talking about is how inflation is also impacting. Put aside the reductions to the fee schedule, look at the cost of providing services to beneficiaries. Look at the costs to just be able to put gas in your car to get to and from your office. I'm sure PSS and Cardinal and all of McKesson, I'm certain that they have not lowered the prices for the bandages and the syringes and all of the things that you need. These costs have gone through the roof. I read a report last week that this time, just 1 year ago, it cost $11,400 approximately less per year for the same goods and services, which was food and gas and those types of things, for a family. So a family now needs to have an extra $11,400 plus just to be able to keep up with the inflation, the hyperinflation that we've seen. Well, anyways,
Sean, just a quick thing, when you're talking about expenses and staffing shortages, yes. One thing that I think people forget too in a physician's practice that wasn't existent maybe in the 70s, 80s, 90s when we had the fee schedules that were tolerable, is that now we have to pay for cybersecurity. Now we have to pay, you know, the increase in malpractice insurance because of all the frivolous lawsuits, even lawsuits that aren't frivolous.
Yeah. Well, and, Change Healthcare
Change Healthcare attack. Yeah. And that was owned by United Healthcare. So I'm like, how come they're not responsible for that? So
that's a good question. And we're going to get some answers on that one, I have a feeling. But okay. Christine Hall, I know you had some comments that you wanted to push out.
Well, ironically, one of the things I'm going to be talking about with AMBA in Hawaii is the anatomy of a CPT code, because that is how we get paid, is the relative value units behind it. And it was funny because as I was reading the proposal last year for the final rule, one of the things that really struck me was that CMS had stated that they did not receive any invoices for increased costs of materials. And they had said that in the proposal. So we got to remember, we've got a responsibility too. Every 5 years, Medicare does an entire review of what it costs to do business, but they do need input from us. So some of these things CMS can go ahead and look at, like salaries or cost of education or time evaluations. But the practice expenses themselves that go into this reimbursement that get influenced by that conversion factor, that's information that we've also got to get involved and we've got to start sharing with Medicare. So they've got some real ideas of what our costs are. Now, I'm not saying it's our fault. Definitely think that that gift that Terry was saying, I don't think that that's been really looked at very well. Maybe someone needs to look at that, what that conversion factor has been, and realize that we're currently getting paid what we were paid in 72. Rent wasn't like that. Salaries weren't like that in 72. So much was different then. And there needs to be a major overhaul. And I think that's the call to action that we really need to share with our listeners is you've got to start getting a little more involved, be louder in order to make sure that you're getting reimbursed for what you're entitled to.
Well, I think you make a great point, Christine, because the most powerful lobbying groups on Capitol Hill, and I speak from experience, are those that are lobbying on behalf of the insurance industry. They are the most powerful lobbyists that are out there. Why do you think the insurance companies are getting what they want out of Congress? Companies. Right? Pharmaceuticals is another one. So I saw Paul. I always enjoy watching Paul's reactions as we talk about certain things. Before I go any further, I want to get some of your insights and some of your analysis on this, Paul.
Well, listening to Terry lay it out and then looking at the raw numbers, this is not a budget. This is an Abbott and Costello sketch. You know, it's like, we're going to give you four, but and we're going to give you four, but it's minus eight. So, see? No, I don't see. You know, and so you get this kind of circular logic. And let's be honest with ourselves. This doesn't go back one or two or three years. This goes back 20 years of people kicking the football down the road and saying, okay, we're going to cut it this far. Well, not really at the last moment. We're actually going to do this. And this is where you get a very unserious budget and a very unserious pay scale. Commensurate with a time where AMC gremlins dotted America's roadways in 1972.
All right, Stephanie, let's talk about what practices need to be aware of. What are some of the things that they need to be cautioned against doing?
So when you have your providers going out to various, events, whatever type it may be, they tend to come back and say, oh, you know, this person spoke and told us we should be doing this or we should be doing that. And a lot more of that is going to come up when we're talking about cuts in reimbursement. And I'm kind of smirking and laughing here because we've had some, they're not really funny actually, because it's a pretty big deal when you implement an entire program into your practice and find out you shouldn't have been paid for any of it. But we're seeing more and more of that. And we've had it before. Terry, don't. But, you know, even Scott and I, he had a client this year, and him and I were looking at this and we were thinking to ourselves, you know, how does this company even exist that's talking the physicians into doing this? And when it comes down to looking at the lack of reimbursement and when all of this is going down and it's getting harder, a lot of times that's when your providers may be coming in and saying, you know, let's do chronic care management, like you were saying earlier, Christine, because we all know that that's done compliantly all the time.
I can't, Stephanie. We can't even.
Yeah, so we don't have to go down that rabbit hole today, but just remember when they come back and say that they heard something at a conference, it really is our job to make sure that we're in these meetings enough, having the conversations enough with administration, so that it's not just the providers going straight to administration that does not know really the ins and outs of what we do day to day, and then they implement something and you see it after the fact when it's being billed out.
Sean, this has got to be deja vu for you, because what we plan on talking about tomorrow, and you said just what Stephanie did, how can these people be in practice when
yeah,
we were just having a conversation, like not even an hour ago, and it was just funny about this.
Yeah. Listen, you know, I think, well, for me, one of the things that practices need to do, irrespective of whether you're a solo physician with a few employees or you're a, you know, an integrated delivery health system, you've got to create a vendor validation program, okay? Because there are vendors out there who are unscrupulous. There are individuals out there that are compensated based on the volume of business that they bring in. They get commissioned. Some of them make a lot of money on their commissions. You need to create a vendor validation program that allows you to vet the materials that the vendors are providing. So many times I have my clients reach out to me and they go, Sean, here's a packet of information that we just got from one of the sales representatives who came in from XYZ Corporation. And they'll say it's Medicare, it's on Medicare letterhead. Well, actually, it's not. What it says is that they went before the HCPCS level 2 committee and they showed enough cause to be issued a HCPCS level 2 code. Remember, the issuance of a HCPCS level 2 code does not mean that the service is approved for billing or reimbursement. Anyone, Paul could go into his garage and whittle something. I don't know if you guys whittle in Wisconsin, but Paul could whittle something and, you know, say that it's FDA cleared, go before the HCPCS committee and be issued a Q code or a J code or a G code. But it does not mean that the service is eligible for reimbursement. And that's where you have to filter out the BS versus the reality. You need to be able to go and look for national coverage guidelines. You need to look for local coverage determinations, local coverage articles. Go and take a look at the medical coverage policies from the commercial payers, because believe it or not, your commercial payers are usually a step to two steps ahead of what Medicare is on policies. You will find a majority of them are saying in advance, hey, this is not covered because it's investigational and or experimental. That's enough for you to know, because I have a lot of people, especially vendors, that will actually come out and say, well, Medicare hasn't said you can't bill for it. Folks, remember, the absence of an LCD or NCD does not mean that it's the wild, wild west and things are open for billing. It means that you need to look at Chapter 3 of the Medicare Program Integrity Manual. I think it's 3.2.3.4, which speaks to medical necessity in the absence of a local coverage determination. And the very first thing that it says is, if the service is considered to be experimental and or investigational, it's not medically necessary. So folks, slow down. I know reimbursements are tough. I know revenue cycles are strained drastically given the reliance that so many, the majority, had on Change Healthcare.
You know, one thing I wanted to mention, yeah, Sean, ahead, on what you were saying and kind of going on top of what Stephanie was saying, I think people miss some things as far as when you start adding things to your billing and trying to bill for things that may or may not be appropriate, they will be taken away. Think about echoes, for example. How many times did everyone do echo Doppler, color flow? And now it's included in the cardiovascular side. You know, never forget this. It was always about, well, if the angioplasty failed and then I went into a stent, I can bill for both a stent and angioplasty. And they did that for 10 years. And I'm like, well, if it's always failing, why are you billing for it? You're telling them that every time I do a PTA, it fails. And they're like, yeah, but because it says if it fails, I can then bill for the stent and I can bill for the angioplasty too. I'm like, oh my God. And so now it says, when you're doing a stenting procedure with or without angioplasty, you know, so it orthopedic, you know, with the chondroplasty, you know, how many times, and they're use a 59 every single time. I'm like, okay, all I'm seeing is that you're doing a little bit of the shaving of the articular space a little bit there on your way out. That's incidental. And now what does it say on a medial metascectomy? It says includes chondroplasty in any area. So they're seeing what you're doing and they're like, you know what? You're not listening. We're taking that back. And don't even get me started on consults. They aren't even on the Medicare fee schedule anymore because everybody billed them wrong.
Yeah.
So
I had a neurologist who, when consults were removed, he decided that he was going to do some creative accounting and make up the difference by billing level fives with
prolonged services.
Prolonged services.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Well, when I see prolonged service, it makes me crazy because then, as Sean's phrase, the unbelievable day, make it make sense. And I'm like, okay, how can you have 36 hours in a day? It make sense to me. Let me hear it. And they're like, well, the CPT says, you know, that I could do that. And because it's with or without, you know, face to face, I'm like, so you were sleeping? It was when you were, you know, what are you doing? 36 hours, you know? So
I love this statement by Ginger. I mean, she works for a payer and they're constantly getting bombarded with vendor requests for additional reimbursement for everything, anything you can buy on Amazon. It's out of control.
That's awesome,
it's absolutely
That's
insane.
Really funny.
Yeah. All right. So let's, So I think we kind of hit the fee schedule. Any last things that we need to talk about on the physician fee schedule? Or are we ready to move on to
just one thing?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Make sure, again, Christine mentioned this, but I just want to make sure that the listeners and watchers just understand this. You can't get something changed unless you participate in the process. It's kind of like voting in this country. If you don't vote, then don't complain. Yet you have to make sure that you're participating in the process. And if you don't, when they say there's a comment period opening, you need to comment. It takes you all of 15 minutes. So even if that, to get into the portal, comment and move on, because it will be looked at. It may not be listened to, but if they get enough of them that are saying the same thing, you know, send an email to your congressman, join MGMA, do something that you're participating in the process to make a change. Otherwise, you're just going to be continuing to look at the fee schedule and say, here we go again. It's like, well, what did you do to help facilitate the change? And like Christine said, Medicare said they didn't get anything about cost increase. How is that possible? How's that possible? Just turn on the TV.
Yeah, it blew my mind. And it wasn't just on one area. It was throughout the proposal. I am one of those nerds. I do read it. And again, it kept coming up. We did not receive any invoices. We did not receive, and it broke my heart.
Nuclear medicine went up by triple. I was just like, what are you talking about? So yeah, go ahead, Sean. Sorry.
All right. No. This is great. So I just want to make sure that I'm leaving enough time for our other two topics. So let's jump into the next one, which is the G0136, which is an assessment of social determinants of health, right? The SDOH. Now, this new HCPCS code and policy change became effective January 1st of 2024. So if you're not familiar with this code, the service is defined as an administration of standardized evidence-based social determinants of health risk assessment. This is 5 to 15 minutes, not more often than every 6 months. Now, this one, dare I say, should not be billed on every single encounter. Okay, so let's open up the dialogue on this one. And Christine just provided me a great link. I'm going to post this to everybody who is watching either live or on the rebroadcast later on. So who wants to take this one out of the gate?
Let me start it.
Go ahead, Terry.
Okay, only because I'm working with AAFP and different associations regarding this code. First of all, it's not an add-on. A lot of our new G codes are add-on codes. This is not an add-on. This is a standalone code. It, again, 5 to 15 minutes. So when you see that time frame, you have to include time in your discussion. So what's a time-based code? That's the first thing. Secondly, there's been some information through Medicare that has been very clear that they say that you only, if there's a suspected reason that there, or an identified reason that the provider needs to have this discussion, they can have the discussion. But if they don't identify anything, then it's not something you should bill for. So it's a tool, and there is something called an HRSN, which is a health-related social needs tool that Medicare has on their website. You can go to CMS. It's really easy. You can Google it, you know, HRSN. It's a screening tool. And basically, it's assessing the domains of social determinants of health, like housing, food, utility, transportation needs, insecurity, not being able to afford your medication, things like that. And what the tool does is it's really more for convenience to facilitate a conversation with the patient. So you're basically able to say, okay, it's not required, but this is what they're saying would be making it clear, or at least supportive, the G0136. Again, every 6 months, and it's not limited to primary care. So if you might get a denial, it could be somebody else billed for it. Not that they couldn't, but they haven't addressed that if multiple providers bill for it. But let's give you a good example. So let's say the patient fills out this tool. They're sitting in the lobby or the waiting room prior to their visit, and they do identify with, or they put on their tool, on the questionnaire, that they're struggling with either keeping food on the table in their house and during their annual well visit, which it can be billed during that. They discuss how this food insecurity, I'm just using the SDOH definition, has impacted their ability to manage their diabetes, okay? And the doctor incorporates this into their care plan for the annual well visit. Remember, you have to show the medical necessity for it. It's not just, oh, the patient mentioned it and move on. And the patient's referred maybe to a case management program, maybe Meals on Wheels, something where they can get needs, okay, that there's going to be followed up on to support diabetes management for their community food options. Absolutely bill for that. So there's action, as Christine puts it, on their SDOH by the provider that's going over it with them. But let's say that this was provided to a patient and there was nothing identified. Patient was taking their medications as needed. There was no financial impact. Patient was back to activities, daily living. And, you know, even if it wasn't their annual well visit, it was just their 6-month check to go over medications. And really everything was going well. Everything was good. There was nothing identified or negative listed. And the patient didn't have any further needs that needed to be addressed, then you wouldn't bill for it. So, and I know that's a tough call, but this has to be done by a qualified healthcare provider or the physician. I did not say that they also allow clinicians on this, clinical staff. But the one thing is that the reason is because if these social factors change or require adjustment to the medical plan for that patient, or considerations relating to the social determinants of health, that wouldn't be done by clinical staff. That'd be done by the billing provider, which is the qualified healthcare professional or physician. So it's worth $20. $19.80 is the allowable. Again, every 6 months. I think it's a really good tool and a really good information that they allowed for it. But I really believe that people are getting out of control with these G codes and just slapping them on everything, and that's not appropriate. And when something also has a frequency guideline, now you've got to monitor that, and you got to make sure somebody's out there monitoring it. All right, go ahead.
Well, one other thing to remember is, you know, sometimes the fact that somebody lives alone is not a social determinant of health. My mom lives alone. She's 80. She does well. She doesn't have any problems whatsoever living alone. So that would not qualify as an assessment. That would not qualify to report that diagnosis. Now, if something changes in the future, living alone might be a problem. She might have difficulties. But just remember that just because somebody has something that maps to a social determinant of health, it may not be a determinant for that person.
Well, Christine,
so think of
one thing I saw a doctor putting on his, because I'm auditing every day, and for clients that, you know, I have ongoing auditing contracts. And he said the patient doesn't want to give up chocolate chip cookies. She's diabetic. And so her sugars kept spiking and her A1 was not at goal. And he put down it was a social determinant of health for food insecurity. I'm like, the patient refusing to give up cookies is not a food insecurity as much as, you know, you'd like to put that in there. And
Wait, did I hear you correctly? Did I hear food insecurity?
Yes. Yeah. And to me,
it's an attack on chocolate chip cookies.
If you can't afford your food, or you don't have access to healthy food, or, you know, you're on food stamps or whatever you're on, you know, you need community services. That's one thing. But, or if you're spending that on alcohol and not on something, I mean, that's just going against medical advice. That's not food insecurity. So be careful, like what Christine said, of what you call an SDOH. It has to fall in those Z code categories. And I think people are creating SDOHs that don't exist sometimes. Sorry, Paul, go ahead. Couldn't help with that one.
So I kind of had a revelation yesterday about the typical patient encounter. You know, we have our fingers in a lot of different functions within a medical office, one of them being financial. And we tend to go in when we're doing compliance work and we conduct a SWOT analysis. Well, every single encounter with a patient is a SWOT analysis. You know, it's up to the physician or the practitioner to identify the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats to that patient. And what we're talking about with social determinants of health are threats, you know, open threats in their activities of daily living or the way they carry themselves throughout the world that are a direct threat to their health outcome with the prescribed management course. And if you don't get at the very least to that point where you identify something, you know, you don't have a threat. The threat box is empty. You don't do the social determinant of health.
Yeah. And
Stephanie, go ahead.
I just wanted to come back to some of what Terry was saying and reiterate some things here from a workflow perspective. So when you think about it, I like, Terry, how you brought up, you know, that's something the patient can fill out with their initial paperwork. Because a lot of the times what I'm finding with this is that the workflow does have clinical staff going over it. And because clinical staff is doing that with the patient, then they think we're going to bill it all of the time. Another thing to be thinking about, too, for those of us that work directly with the codes, remember when we're in the CPT manual, there's different meanings behind screenings and assessments. Assessment means that there's something there that there's a concern for, they need to look further into it. It's not, you know, do we have to just see if this patient has a problem? We already know that that patient has a problem, so they need to dig in further, and that's what we look at when we talk about an assessment. So workflow should not be clinical staff billing it out. The outcome, like Terry said, is that provider focusing on it and what is the provider going to do with the known outcome of the issues that that patient has.
So Terry, let me ask you a question. In the final rule, they specifically lay out the fact that this GO-136 should not be billed for all Medicare patients.
Correct.
Why did they put that on there?
Because there's a twofold reasoning behind that. One is with the social, with the annual well visit, and one is with a problem oriented visit. So in a problem oriented visit, you are looking at issues that, you're dealing with chronic conditions and access to care to see if the patient actually has an issue, like Stephanie was saying, that during that check, are those factors affecting their access to get all the things they need to have done on that that medical decision? On the annual well visit, again, we're going just through risk factor reductions, preventative. And so as the patient's filling it out, by the way, is there any issues that we need to be aware of? I think more than that, risk factor reduction. And so I think Medicare was just trying to be clear that it's like Stephanie said, it's not a screening. We're not just saying, hey, do they might have something. They're saying, there's an indication we have to follow up with something. And it talks about the unmet social need. So that means the doctor's doing something to meet that unmet social need. So you have to look at the language and understand when it's an assessment, it means you're actually assessing the situation that could influence that patient's health. And what are you doing to meet that unmet social need? And so that's why it wouldn't be on every single patient, because sometimes it could just be, you know, a suspected need that turned out not to be there, or it could actually be an identified need that they have to follow up with. If that makes sense.
It does. Excellent. All right. So two topics down, one to go. And I think this one's going to generate a lot of conversation. So we're going to go to evaluation and management services. Because, again, the targeted probe and educate program from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is now focusing on these level three and level four services pretty extensively. And Terry, you and I have had conversations, and I know tomorrow we're going to have another conversation as we're talking about annual wellness visits, and we're going to be talking about meaningful evaluations. And I know E&M services will kind of tie into that from, you know, a historical and objective standpoint. But I think there's a lot of providers that once they are exposed by a TPE audit or even by a commercial payer audit, I think they're going to find themselves in a world of trouble, because people have taken the definition provided by the American Medical Association for E&M services when they changed over in 2021, you know, and the fact that they are saying the history and exam do not count towards the overall level of service. But providers are ignoring the fact that a medically appropriate history and physical still have to be taken. So let me stop there and Stephanie, kind of drive this conversation and let's see where we go.
So a couple of things too. I just checked this before our session here today. You want to look at your MAC's website. They will have sections related to TPE and what the current targets are, basically. And I had a patient or a client who had a letter coming in from Novitas. And when I looked at Novitas's website weeks ago, it said that level threes and fours were going to be a TPE target. But then when I checked it today, right before this, I saw that they were also adding in level fives, and they were listed as established visits. So, you know, just be mindful. But in general, it's interesting to me because I think this is going to be the first big push that we're going to have with our 2021 guidelines being looked at more closely by the payers in a wider range or a wider scope, because it's going to affect everybody pretty much, a large volume of people. So one of the things to keep in mind, and I continue to find this every single client that I work with, when more so with our specialists, they still are thinking about this concept that the level fours are supported or the level fives are supported because they have complex patients, because the complaints are complicated. They've got to work through, they've got to figure things out. But then, you know, even this morning I was looking at a neurology practice, and they own a lot of the equipment that they're doing testing with and things like that. So when we start to whittle it all down, yes, we have that complicated patient, but a lot of times we're not going to have the higher level of service supported. One other thing that I'm finding too, and this actually happened with a client, when they received a letter, they kind of freaked out. They wanted a quick meeting on a Monday morning to talk through again that grid and what the requirements were. And as I broke down every bullet, they started to say, oh, I do that, but it's not in my note. You know, with things like an interpretation. And then when we talk about the details so we can identify it's an external test. And, you know, all of those little things that come in that are in the big document from AMA when everybody's just looking at that grid. So I think overall we are going to find that there's going to be a lot of issues, because a lot of times even if that work is being done, we're not seeing it in the notes like we need to.
But Stephanie, a lot of that has to do with people are still so dependent on the EMR. EMRs are still written in 95, 97. They're looking for the wrong things in the EMR. There's still 10, 12 pages of documentation with the problem list pulled over and the medications from the last 10 years pulled over. I think that's part of this problem, is the medical record itself is just so convoluted with stuff that is not necessary for payment purposes. I'll never tell a provider what to put in their note clinically, but from a payment purpose, it's not about volume.
Well, the thing I've seen most often too, and this goes back even before the new E&M guidelines, but now it seems to be worse, is that I still have providers saying, well, I refilled medication, so that's automatically a four. Or the patient's got two chronic conditions that are stable. And now they use the verbatim wording that's in the how-to, you know, come to an E&M service. They're like, my patients, two chronic conditions that are stable are, and then they'll do this Mickey Mouse exam and no history. And then I'll see in medical decision-making where it'll say continue meds and they're like level four. I'm like, what are you talking about? But then they'll get another auditor that'll say, no, they've met it. Usually the one that's on the internet, and Sean and I won't mention his name, but it's just like, it's frustrating because people seem to be documenting based on billing and not based on medical necessity. And it's so frustrating because this is a legal document. And I'm just going to throw it to Sean's side.
Well, Sean, I go back to chapter 12 of the Medicare Program Integrity Manual.
I mean, where you have to be able to support what they're doing. And somebody saying continue meds,
yeah,
where there's just a list, no dates, no reason for doing it, no management evidence, you know, that's not enough.
Well, a couple of things, right? So I go to chapter 12 of the Medicare Program Integrity Manual, 30.6.1. Everybody on this podcast knows what I'm talking about. And specifically, it speaks to the fact that the volume of documentation should actually play zero role in the remuneration that a provider seeks, right? Because it's based on medical necessity being the overarching criteria in addition to the individual elements of the CPT code. So when we start talking about the EMRs, and this is something that I talk about a lot in federal cases. I talk about this almost to the point of nausea, where I have to explain to a jury that, look, an electronic medical record, while it has its benefits, it has a lot of downsides. And these are programs that contain algorithms. These algorithms are created by non-clinical individuals. Now, they may have some insight from a nurse, maybe a doctor at some point, but I don't know who said it, Christine or Terry, you hit the nail on the head. These EMRs have not adapted to the 2021 and 2023 inpatient changes to E&M documentation guidelines. They are still, for the better or for the worst part, reliant on 1995 and 1997 documentation guidelines, because it's still point and click for the elements of the history, the exam, and the medical decision making. Now, you go over to what Terry was just talking about here a moment ago, which is prescription drug management. And it's always interesting because, you know, I get a lot of people, and sometimes Terry does this to me, and she's like, well, I know you don't agree with me on something. And I think she's just picking a fight for whatever reason. And I'm like, no, Terry, I actually do agree with you. When somebody says continue meds as planned, that is not prescription drug management. Prescription drug management involves the active management of the patient's medications. It's increases, decreases, discontinuation, starting of a new medication, not starting a medication because of a contraindication with another medication. They're just simply saying continue meds as planned. That is not a level four E&M service. And the other misconception that I want to just quash right now, just because you have prescription drug management does not automatically qualify you as a level four E&M service. So before I give myself a stroke, let me stop there for a minute. And one of y'all kind of jump in and lead this horse to water, and let's see if we can get it to drink.
So I have one additional comment I want to make on the EMR thing. So there's a particular system that automates a lot of what is done. Some of it obviously is driven by the user, but they build things in so that the system will recognize different treatment plans and different components of that and where they feel the risk lies. Well, even that has been problematic because I have had different clients, orthopedic clients, and I definitely didn't agree with the level of service. And when we went in and started looking at how the system breaks everything down, we could clearly see that they kept mapping this particular drug for a procedure always to a higher level. And when we went back, had the conversation, the practice administrator was having a lot of issues because the system could not just change it for them. They saw my points. They saw the different resources that I provided. They agreed, but the EMR vendor would not change it because it would have to be changed for everybody across the board. So then, you know, you're really in this situation where if you don't have coders, what are you going to do? You've got to make sure in some way that you're not personally carrying the risk. And this one EMR, I do believe a part of their sales pitch is that, you know, they've got attorneys, they're going to back you up. But it is that provider, that physician's claim, the APP's claim, their name, their NPI number. What else is going to be done here? I haven't really seen where you can go back and say, well, so-and-so set it up this way, because I've worked with a lot of EMR systems that automate the wrong codes to drop and things like that. So we have to not just think about, oh yeah, that's a level three, that's a level four. But when you're doing these reviews, first of all, knowing this is a TPE, you need to be aware of when you've last audited. You should have internal audits, you should have external audits. You've got to have people looking at this. And then as a part of that, you dig into your EMR system and see how it works. How's it directing things? How are the templates set up? Various things like that.
Yeah. And there's one thing that's kind of funny. You just triggered something. I was looking at an audit recently. Level fives. I have a client who they send me all their level fives where they didn't leave the office. And this one oncologist just kept reporting level fives on post-op mastectomies and cancer surgeries. And if you read the note, he's like, well, I'm not doing the mastectomies. I'm not doing the surgery so I can bill for it. But if you read the note, it's all about the incision site, the wound site, the post-op management. And it's like, but you're talking about the post-op. That has to go back to the surgeon. I didn't see you talk anything about talking about radiation or chemo or what's coming up or managing anything that you would manage. You're just talking about the 2-week post-surgery visit. So you can, and they're doing it telehealth, just kill me now. So I was just like, you know, you're trying to slide something in that isn't what it is. And that we got into a pretty heated discussion about this, saying, but since I didn't do the surgery, I get it. I'm like, but you are commenting on the surgery. No, you don't. I won, by the way. But it's just, you know, it's frustrating because you're trying to protect your physicians. You're trying to protect your clients. The other thing Stephanie mentioned and Christine mentioned about the EMR, that's a tool. That's not a defensible position. I mean, I know Sean's probably blown all kinds of cases out of the water, and Paul too, by somebody saying, well, the EMR is what I use. And they probably laughed and went, oh, bless your heart. But here's the problem. The EMR pulls so much information through, and let's just talk about that telehealth, you know, and say that you did a, you know, constitutional exam and you actually did the blood pressure and the weight and all this. If you actually go back to look at the 2020 rules on telehealth, which some of those flexibilities are still in place, it says you have to have FDA approved devices. And it says it right in the rules. And people are like, oh, I didn't read that. Well, the patient has an iPhone. Well, that's not an FDA approved device for certain things. There's an app within that for some things, possibly, but not straight across the board. And the other thing, when there's palpable, you know, exams that you can't do over the phone and you can't do virtually. And we see that. To me, that negates the record for me. I stop reading. I'm like, you know what? You can't have it.
And let me tell you, stop relying.
They say, can I have part of it? They want to know if they can have part of it.
And stop relying on those watches that you finger onto the little button and it takes your EKG and it says, it does not detect myocardial infarctions, but you may be in AFib. Stop
it.
Looking at those watches and using those those crazy apps.
Well, and
those things don't work.
They don't work. Well, on this last point, then I'll send it over to Christine. You know, I had a practice that I had to actually go on site to talk to them about their audit fail. It was a Medicare audit and then a Medicare Advantage plan that hired me to audit them. And they're like, you have to go on site. We're not going, you're going. I'm like, well, what do you mean? They're like, we've audited them 3 times and now we just want $700,000 back. You decide what they're paying back. And I'm like, really? That's mean. So I go on site and I'm talking to them. And a lot of it was telehealth. And they're basically saying that, you know, they can do this, that, and the other, and their exams were fine. There was, you know, because what they could see, you know, virtually, I'm like, okay, but your surgery practice. You can't do that virtually, you know, or they were basically trying to time everything and they're using AI, which was really a fun conversation. And I'm just like, you can't time that if that's who it's done. And then I looked at their workflow and all the staff was doing all of the basics on their exams, taking all the history, and they were using the time for that history and stuff. And it says it right in the AMA guidelines. You can't use staff to do that. And so, you know, and Ginger's right. She put up there, oh, but we can get paid for all the accessories with those fancy devices. No, you can't. No, you can't. But I'll send it back over. I see so much in auditing where everyone's just trying to meet the definition of the code and not trying to understand the medical necessity of what you're doing for the patient. And it's driving me crazy. It's like, it's not just about coding and billing. It's about the patient. So Christine, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to say something that's kind of harsh. I'll be honest with you. I'm very tired of hearing, I didn't know this, and I'm really tired of hearing, but they paid us for it. Listen, if you have a good compliance program in place, there will never be that we didn't know, because you're constantly meeting and discussing these issues. It's how you get paid, guys. It's one of the most important things that you need to do in a practice. Besides taking good care of your patients, if you don't get paid appropriately, if you don't avoid overpayments, if you don't avoid inappropriate billing, then there will come a time when you're no longer there to help take care of those patients. And if you're relying on that EMR and you're simply stating patient, stable, continue meds, when the new doctor has to come in for whatever reason and take over those patients for you, how are they really going to know what's going on with that patient? So, I mean, it sounds harsh, but you're supposed to know these things. So I'm tired of hearing that.
I have a question. Go ahead, Paul. For Paul. So Paul, I had this audit. You tell me how you would handle this. And the doctor basically started incorporating the chronic care management. Shout out to Stephanie there. And we were trying to get information from this company. And he said, well, the company's in India. So, and I'm like, oh no. And I said, are they providing services from India? And are they just their billing company? And they're just like, oh no, they're the ones that provide services much cheaper than the US. And they just went on and on. And we know we can't do that. And the doctor said, well, who says we can't do that? And I pulled up the Medicare rules on that and the Social Security Act about out of country. And the doctor was just flabbergasted, just couldn't believe that because everyone goes out of country, why we couldn't use that. How would you handle that? Talking to a physician. I wanted to run the other way and just go to Starbucks and go grab a coffee and say, I'm done. But I had to handle it. So what would you do?
I would use the corollary of internet customer service. I usually fix it myself anyway when I unplug it and plug it back in. And it usually works much better when my own staff documents that service and has contact with a patient that they know that gives them clinically relevant information. Stop outsourcing. Stop. Just stop. Never do it.
Well, I think and we need to be very clear on this, right? Because clinical work that is performed outside of the United States is never reimbursable. It's not countable towards anything. It shouldn't be done. Administrative work, back-end revenue cycle management services, those types of things, if you choose to offshore, you can do that. But anything that is tied to the clinical care of a patient, anything that drives reimbursement from a payer to a provider, must be performed by U.S.-based in-country providers. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. This is the U.S. healthcare system, not a global healthcare system.
But Sean, we didn't know. And yeah, we got listen, paid anyway.
I will tell you, and you know, again, I know all of you guys and gals, you know, on this panel, engage in litigation services. You know, you're subject matter experts. Some of you may actually have testified or continue to testify for bench trials, arbitrations, mediations, you know, jury trials, whatever it may be. I will tell you from my experience, okay? From my experience, when I have a provider that says, I did not know, what I actually try to look at is the waiver of liability clause under the Social Security Act and under Medicare, right? Which is a provider without fault is what it's actually called. Now, do I have cases where I can legitimately, with a straight face and under oath without perjuring myself, look a jury in the face, in the eyes and say, absolutely, this provider could not have reasonably been expected to know what the expectations of him or her were. And the reason why is in the last 6 months, we've had 4 regulatory changes to this service. We have inconsistencies in LCDs. We have inconsistencies in LCAs. Listen, only 50% of the CPT codes out there actually have an LCD. Think about that for a minute. Only 50% of them. So if the payer puts nothing into writing to say yay or nay, or this is what the expectations are, this is the frequency to what the services can be billed, can a legitimate argument be made that the provider without fault comes into play? Possibly. I will tell you, though, on the mainstream things that we are talking about, telehealth services, evaluation and management services, the majority of mainstream procedures that are being done, like chondroplasties that we were talking about and arthroscopic procedures and those types of things, there's absolutely no way a provider can say, I didn't know. When it comes to whether or not they are outsourcing clinical services for their beneficiaries, there's no way they can say, I didn't know. But I go back to what Christine said, and I agree with you 100%. But I'll put a caveat in there. As long as you have an effective compliance program, meaning that it is continuously being audited and monitored for its efficacy, as long as you are making compliance the tagline and not the punchline, as long as you have dedicated professionals looking at the policies, procedures, and making determinations as to when to update these policies and/or procedures, I agree with you. You should not be making any boneheaded mistakes. We are all human and we make mistakes. That's the difference between the term erroneous and fraud, right? That's the difference between an honest mistake versus knowledge, or under the criminal statute, intent to create a scheme or an artifice against the federal programs. Where a compliance plan fails to work is when it's not audited, when it's not monitored, where somebody went out online for $99.95 and downloaded a Word document and changed the term practice and put their name in there and clicked replace all. And at the end, it says we made 147 changes. They save it. They put it into an electronic file somewhere. They print it off and put it in a 3-ring binder. And they go, we have a compliance plan. No, you don't. You have something that's not worth the paper it's written on. So that's where providers have big problems. And that's where a compliance plan does not work in a trial. And I tell providers all the time when I have conversations with them, when they say to me, Sean, I have an effective compliance program, I ask them the first question, what makes your compliance plan effective? And they just kind of stare at me with this blank
look. Let me blow the dust off it real quick, Sean, and then I can answer that question.
Yeah. Go ahead, Paul. I see you want to say something.
Well, you said $99.95. I'm thinking that that compliance plan is as effective as an Earl Scheib paint job, which was the same price.
People don't remember those from the 80s and early 90s. All right. So that's going to, before I conclude, any questions, comments, concerns about what we just got done talking about? Christine, I'll start with you.
No. I think I was pretty loud and proud a little while ago. I'll settle with that.
Absolutely. Miss Fletcher.
I'm good. You know, everybody says Terry ranted enough. Here we go.
Stephanie Howard.
So just one more thing. I see that someone in attendance asked a question, Debbie. So Debbie, the way that they would come back and take the money if the services are offshore, usually the companies are onshore. So a lot of times the work is outsourced. So there will be a U.S.-based company running some things. A lot of times you'll find, too, that their administrative staff is based here in the U.S. as well. And then the actual work that's being done is what's offshore.
Absolutely. Great point. I ran into a situation, Paul, you were with me on a client, where we ran into the situation. And they said, no, everything's done here onshore. And I asked them how big their square footage was in their office that they rented in this area. And they said, well, what does that matter? And I knew my answer right then and there. Listen, when people say, oh, all of our work is done based here in the US, it's just all living in the cloud. Folks, the cloud goes all over the world. All right. There's one last thing that, Angela Jordan posted about anyone that's in the Wisconsin Physician Services GHA's jurisdiction. You need to watch their E&M videos on what they expect to see for E&M documentation. So grateful that you posted that, Ms. Jordan, because you know what? I love when a payer is willing to put into writing or onto a video precisely what it is that they expect from a documentational standpoint. All right, Paul Spencer, any last words of wisdom?
We talked a little bit about TPE audits. It's very smart not just to look at the E&M sections of your Mac website. Look at the payment integrity section as well. They're going to be telegraphing a lot of the things they're going to be doing based on cert results, and they're going to share the cert results that are most notable in that Mac jurisdiction, and they're basically telegraphing exactly what they're going to be working on for the next 6 months, whether it's E&M or any other type of service that they find has a high error rate within that jurisdiction.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of The Compliance Guy. As always, thank you to Paul, Stephanie, Christine, and Terry for joining the podcast and taking time out of their extremely busy schedules. And to each and every single one of you who tunes in, logs on, and hangs out with us just for a little while on our Monday auditing, compliance, and coding podcast, well, auditing, coding, and compliance podcast, thank you all so much. Terry and I are going to be back tomorrow with another great episode of the Hashtag Terry Tuesday. We're going to be talking about the IPPE, the AWV, the do's, the don'ts, and all things in between. So look for that tomorrow. It should be airing about 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. All right. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another brand new episode of the Monday Roundtable. So keep an eye out. We'll be posting to keep you all in the loop. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.